Hi, it's Elspeth Beard, and welcome to Ride and Talk, the BMW Motorrad podcast, and I'm here with Andy Jukes.
Greetings all. I hope you've been keeping safe and healthy at home during these challenging times, and that you've been able to enjoy loads of podcasts and catch up on all those motorcycling books you've always promised yourself you'd read, if you only had more time. If you haven't read Lone Rider by Elspeth Beard yet, then we've got a very special podcast for you. As the runaway successor, this recently published story of a unique and life-changing adventure that actually happened nearly 40 years ago has even surprised its author. The world was a very different place in 1982 when 23-year-old architecture student Elspeth Beard fired up her 1974 R60/6 Boxer BMW and left the bright lights of London behind for a two-year, 35,000-mile journey into the unknown. In doing so, she became the first British woman to ride a motorcycle around the world. Although she kept diaries of her amazing adventure, she put them away upon her return and forgot about them for nearly 30 years until a journalist commissioned a story about her original journey. This story caught the public imagination and was posted everywhere and really put Elspeth's overlanding exploits on the map. This was followed up with a short BMW Motorrad film which actually brought her to the attention of a Hollywood producer who suggested making a feature-length movie of her exploits. Whisked over to LA, Elspeth read the first script, which bore no real resemblance to her actual journey, but made her think that she really needed to get the whole trip down on paper, an authentic account, if you like, that told her story exactly how it happened. A book deal was subsequently struck, and Lone Rider was published in 2017. Much to her surprise, it's gone on to be a huge success in the mainstream as well as the adventure travel community. As well as running a busy architect's practice, Elspeth's in strong demand for talks, presentations and even book tours. But she was happy to tell Ride and Talk how the bike, and the book, has changed her life. So great to have you here, or great to have me here at your architect's practice, rather, Elspeth. The past couple of years, they've been a whirlwind of activity for you. So please tell me what's been going on in your life with the book and all of the other bits.
Oh, it's been absolutely amazing. It really has. Because, I mean, the book was published in 2017 and there was obviously a sort of hive of activity when it first came out. And I kind of assumed it would die down after, you know, 6 months or a year. But it's actually just gone more and more. And I've had an incredible time. I've been invited to all sorts of events and bike shows and giving talks and presentations. And not only in the UK, all over Europe, I've done two book tours in America, and I'm doing another one as well, coming up in May. So it's just been absolutely extraordinary, and I've been having actually a great time, which has been really good.
Did you ever imagine the book would be such a success? Because it was a long time coming, and it might have never happened.
I know. To be honest, I never ever imagined it would be as, you know, as well received as it had. Really, not in a million years. It's just great with all the. I've received, you know, so many letters and emails and cards from people, and it's been absolutely, yeah, amazing. Especially as it all came from, you know, when I got back in 1984, there was very little interest in what I'd done, and so I very much sort of parked it all away and didn't even think about the trip at all for about 25 years. And so now for it all to sort of come back, and I do find it really odd that a trip that I did in, you know, like 35 years ago now, that at the time I did the trip, it had this huge impact on my life and changed the course of my life, really. And then it kind of lies dormant for 35 years. And then now it's having a sort of another huge impact on my life all over again. It's just, I don't know, it's just very weird.
Yeah, I mean, just to think that you sat on those diaries for best part of three decades thinking no one was interested.
Well, I nearly threw them away. I remember when I was moving out of London and I was moving to the Water Tower in the early 90s, and I looked at this cardboard box that had all my diaries, photos, letters, everything, and it was literally my trip was in this box, and I nearly put it on a skip, and I thought, well, nobody wanted to know. I haven't looked at it in 10 years. And so I very, very nearly threw it away, and I just kind of, just at the last minute, I thought, well, you never know, I might want to look at it one day or something. So I put it in the
boot
of the car.
One last read.
Yeah. I put it in the boot of my car, but, you know, it's yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, the last time we met was about 4 years ago when we were making that short film about original overlanders and your around-the-world trip in the early 80s. Now, I've since seen that film pop up all over the place, and people really seem to identify with the messages that it contained in there.
Yeah, it's they do. I think there is a sort of interest in trips that people did a long time ago, because I think traveling then was very, you know, it's not like it is now. And I think there is a lot of interest in trips, you know, in people who did trips long before, you know, the internet and technology and adventure bikes with all their aluminium panniers and all of this sort of stuff. So, yeah, and I suppose I suppose people find it sort of inspirational, really, that. That it was possible to do a trip all those years ago.
You said that you get lots of messages and letters from people who have read the book. What kind of things are they saying? Because, I mean, you were kind enough to send me an early proof of the book before it was published, and I read it from start to finish over the course of a weekend, and what I personally loved was it was so much more than a travelogue. It was also a history lesson to me about how the world was nearly 40 years ago, seen through the eyes of a 20-something-year-old woman travelling alone on a 1974/6. So what kind of feedback do you get now from people?
I get a mixture of stuff. I mean, I get a whole range of stuff. I mean, most of it is that people just thank me for writing such an inspirational book and for being so honest because I didn't want the book to just be, a motorcycle travel book about riding a bike. You know, it was about a lot more, because the journey was a lot more for me than just riding a motorbike around the world. But I've had some really strange ones. I had lots of strange ones, but I had one where this guy said that he'd been trying to encourage his girlfriend to, you know, get into riding bikes for years and years, and she just wouldn't do it. And then he bought her my book and she read it. And within a month, she passed her test. And as he was writing a letter, she was off in Europe, riding around Europe all on her own. And so it's great. And I get lots of people saying, oh, I'm going to buy this book because I want to, you know, I want to see if my wife will get interested in riding bikes and things. And then I get emails and letters from people from women who say that they'd always wanted to do a trip, but they've always been really nervous and really worried about doing it. But having read my book, they're leaving on their first trip, you know, like next month. So it's great. It's absolutely, I find it extraordinary that my story and writing my book has had that impact on people. It's, I don't know, I still can't sort of really understand it. It's weird.
What about people from outside of motorcycling who have come across the book and just looked at it as a piece of travel writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the letters and correspondence I've got have been from motorcyclists, I have to say. I've had one or two from women who have read it and found it very inspirational or whatever. But I would say most of the correspondence I've had is from other motorcyclists.
And as you say, you've already done lots of speaking engagements across Europe, and you've done some book tours. You're heading off to the States soon on another book tour. Have you enjoyed the process of reconnecting with the motorcycling community? Or perhaps there wasn't a community to connect with all those years ago?
No, well, there kind of wasn't really. And I think because in the early 80s when I started to ride bikes, there were so few women riding. And I kind of kept to myself a lot. I didn't really get involved with... it was just a different time then. And the community that exists now, it just wasn't like that then. I mean, you had local bike clubs and things, but it was all very small and very local. And I kind of lived in central London, and there just wasn't anywhere really. So, and I was quite happy doing my own thing, to be honest. So, but now it's fantastic because I get to go to see all these places and meet all these really interesting people, and it's just a whole world that I was kind of completely unaware of. So it's been fantastic.
And just back to the female riders topic, just briefly, have you been able to offer lots of words of encouragement or advice? Have you been contacted by women riders saying, you know, I'd love to do something like this, but maybe I haven't got it in me, or, you know, am I brave enough? What should I do? What are the first steps?
I've had a few, and I always sort of say, you know, the hardest thing is actually leaving. You know, you just have to take that big step and just leave. And, you know, and once you've done that, you kind of realise how easy it is, and actually how, you know, despite what the media might say all the time, actually how safe a lot of the world is, and how incredibly friendly and kind all the people that you'll meet are. So it's just taking that first step that I think people find very, very difficult, sort of taking themselves out of their comfort zone. So I think... So I just try and encourage them and give them that little bit more of a push, so they will actually, you know, they will actually take the step and leave.
And then since we last met, you've also featured in a campaign about 100 pioneering women. How's that experience been?
That was great, actually, because Anita, who was the person who was doing that, she's the photographer, and she started the project like 10 years ago, because it takes like an awful long time to find 100 pioneering women who are the first in their field of whatever it is. And so she started the project like 10 years, and the idea was the first exhibition was in 2018, which was the centenary of women being given the vote. So she contacted me probably about 4 years ago, so before the book was published, but she found me some stuff on me on the internet, and she contacted me and said, would I be like to be part of it? And I said, absolutely. And of course, you never know with these things whether anything's ever going to happen or whether it's whatever, but I didn't really care. I'd do these things because I liked what she was doing, and you know, and I was very happy to support her and be part of it. But then, of course, it was another year and a half or 2 years before the exhibition was actually,
And what about the travelling? Do you still have the desire to travel, or did you get it out of your system all those years ago?
Well, I travelled a lot when I got back. In the last 30 years, I've travelled a lot. I mean, I'd say now I mean, I'm actually going off to Tajikistan on a bike trip. I do like my comforts now, I have to say. And I do, sleeping in a tent and all that, I really struggle with it. I know I shouldn't say that, but I really do. And I do like my comforts now. So I suppose I'm a bit more picky where I go, but I still love, I love to travel, and I still think, a motorbike is still the best way, I think, to do it. But obviously I do much shorter. I can't take whole chunks of time off because of my work and things. So
what's in Tajikistan?
It's just got lots of lovely mountains, and it's fairly unspoiled, and I just kind of like to have a look, and so
this will be the first time
I haven't. Yep, it's the first time I've never been to Tajikistan before. So.
And if you like it, there are a lot of other stands as well, aren't there?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So going back to that original trip, if you can summarise, what do you think you learnt most from that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I obviously learned a lot about myself. I think when you're kind of pushed to your limits, you really understand what you're capable of. Obviously, I saw a lot of the world. I learned a lot about other people, other cultures. I learned a lot about dealing with people and the best way to get people to do what you want them to do, persuade them. So I learned a lot about that. And I think I just, it was, I think when I got back from my trip, I really felt as if I could cope and deal with anything. And I think that's what I really learned. And I, you know, there was not anything, there wasn't a problem I couldn't deal with or anything I couldn't solve. And that's, I've sort of taken through my work as well. A lot of the projects I take on are projects that most other architects won't touch because they are a nightmare. They're really difficult, really tricky. They people don't understand how they're going to deal with all the issues and all the technical problems with these very difficult and unusual buildings. And so a lot of architects go, I just cut off. But they all seem to end up on my doorstep. But I don't look at them as a problem. I look at them as an
opportunity.
An opportunity and a challenge. So so I just view it in a different way. And I think my trip and what I learned and experienced and just dealing with all the problems that I had to just taught me to just to tackle anything. So
it seems to be a common theme among people who've done big journeys, big long journeys as well, in that it gives them confidence coming back into the real world, in inverted commas, you know, in their professional lives, whether they're starting out on something new or going back to what they were doing before. They seem to be able to attack it with this sort of renewed confidence that nothing is impossible.
Yeah.
It's just how you view it, how you approach
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and I think the problems that you'll face sort of on the road when you're on your own in a foreign country and you have to deal with these problems, it makes you realise that when you come home, the problems that you thought were problems when you were home actually weren't problems at all. So it just puts things in perspective, I think. And that's why I think I like to keep travelling all the time, because then it reminds me. I don't get lulled into this way of thinking that all these little things are problems. And so I think it's important to keep travelling, and then it sort of keeps you in perspective of what's really important.
Yeah, it keeps you grounded, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
What is it we say? First world problems.
First world problems.
So would you still recommend overland travel in this day and age?
I actually think overland travel in this day and age is probably more relevant than it was. And I think with all the media and the negative press that a lot of the world, you know, gets, I think it sort of instills this sort of fear in people. And I think that's a dangerous thing. I think it's, you know, people are frightened of what they don't understand. And I think the best way to understand people, cultures, other countries is to visit them and go and see them. So I think it's incredibly important that people, I think it should be part of everybody's education to, you know, to travel and to see the world. I think it's really, really important.
What a great idea. Now, on the original journey, there were lots of places that you went to, but there were also lots of places that you couldn't get to for a variety of reasons. So have you still got any of them on your bucket list, apart from Tajikistan?
I'd like to go to Bhutan, actually.
I can highly recommend it.
I'd love to go to Bhutan. I would like to go to... I've done some of South America, but I haven't got such a huge continent. I haven't done. So there's certainly some countries in South America I would like to return, or I'd like to get to. Well, that's probably about it, actually. There's not a lot.
Yeah, well, I can put you in contact with someone in Bhutan. But did you know that the King of Bhutan rides a GS?
Yes. Seriously.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. So
brilliant.
There's definitely a connection there for sure. So, you of course you've got your day job running your own architect's practice. Does your background story often become a talking point with your clients?
Well, actually, quite a lot of my clients, when I first go and see them, they because obviously they Google looking for an architect, and then all this other stuff comes up about my motorcycling and they often say, "Oh yes, we found all this stuff on the internet about you riding motorbikes." So it does come up. And actually, I've got a few jobs, I think, because the people have been motorcyclists themselves. And then I went to see a client recently for a job, and I think a friend of theirs had actually had my book, which I'd signed for him, which I couldn't. So yeah, it does definitely come up.
So it's been a good icebreaker, and it's been a door opener in some parts.
Yeah, it has.
And of course, where you are in Surrey, it's pretty busy. Do you often ride your bike to site meetings or client visits at certain times of the year?
I ride my bike during the summer. I'm not really a winter rider much anymore, but I do during the summer months. I will use my bike and go to site visits and visit sites and go to clients, and some of them look slightly oddly at me, but.
And how is the Slash 6? Is she still...
Slash 6 is still going strong. I don't ride her a huge amount, to be fair. I tend to ride her to... Because if I do talks and presentations and things, people say, oh, can you ride your bike? And so if it's not a million miles away, then I will ride. And during the summer, I quite like to give her a bit of a run out. So she's still going strong, so...
Of course, 2020 is the 40th anniversary of the GS. And as well as your Slash 6, I know that you've got, or at least you had, a beautiful R80 GS Basic from 1998.
Is it 98? It's actually the Kalahari. It was the one that apparently that was just for the South African market initially. That's what I was told.
Okay.
South African market, and it was called the Kalahari. And they're all the same, white with a blue frame. And then I don't know what happened after that. So it's a 1998 model.
So how long have you had that one now then?
I bought it 2003. So I've had that, well, whatever, 15 years.
And
so.
what do you love in particular about that bike? You're obviously not planning on selling it to
me,
are you?
I'm absolutely not planning on selling it. I love it. I actually almost think it's the perfect bike because... It's basic, and that's what I love about it. You know, I can service it, I can fix it. It's not full of electronics, and I think for riding around the world or doing a long trip, it's actually for me. You know, I suppose in my mind, I'm more used to having to look after myself on the side of the road because I didn't travel with all the the internet and all the rest of it to help you. So it's very like my old Slash 6, so I can easily work on it myself. I can service it all myself. It's got no electronics. And I just like the thought of always being able to fix it on the side of the road with a basic box of tools. And I think that's just because I did that long trip, and that's just ingrained in the way I think about doing trips on bikes. I like to be able to fix it anywhere, or certainly to be able to feel that I can fix it anywhere.
It's a state of mind, isn't it?
You know, I think it is
a peaceful feeling,
yeah,
of confidence in a way.
And I mean, I think all these newer bikes, I mean, they're fantastic, they're a lot more reliable probably, but I mean, I wouldn't know where to start with them. And if they go wrong, it's kind of, So, and I just don't like that. I like to know about my bike. I like to be able to think I can take the engine apart and fix it and put it back together again.
What was the reason that you didn't opt for a GS originally? Was it because they were too new at the time, too expensive maybe?
And to be honest,
also maybe unproven. It was early days.
No, I don't think it was that, to be honest. I don't think I really knew about them. Well, that's not true. I bought my bike in 1979, And I'm not sure when the first GS came. It was 1980. Yeah. So when I bought my R60, they didn't exist. So that's why, although I left in 82, and they obviously the GS had been out for 2 years, I'd already bought my R60 by then.
Did you buy the R60 because of the way it looked? Because it's still a stunning looking bike now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I bought my R60. That's quite complicated because at the time I was in love with this guy called Alex, who I was at university with, and it was a friend of his who was selling the bike. So it was really more that's just the bike that was being offered to me. I mean, I knew I wanted to buy a BMW. And because in those days, I mean, now there's such a wide range of different bikes, but in those days, if you wanted, you know, there was the sort of cheaper bikes, and then there was the BMW, which was just kind of just streets ahead of everything else. And if you wanted to do a long trip or anything like that, I mean, you just didn't think about using I certainly didn't think about using any other bike but a BMW. I mean, they were just in a different league to what other bikes you could buy then. I mean, now, obviously, it's probably closed a bit, but and I just knew I wanted a BMW. And the fact it was a 60/6, I didn't really know much about them at all. I didn't educate myself in all the different, models or anything. It was just it just happened to be the bike that this friend of Alex's was selling.
Well, it did the job just fine, and you did the job just fine as well. I mean, I love that bike, and I also love the fact that you're still riding it. So, thanks for talking to us, Elspeth. Where can people find this book if they haven't found it already?
Well, it's available at all bookshops, I'm told, Amazon, and if you want a signed copy, then you can buy it on my website, which is just elspethbeard.com, and I'll send you a signed copy. And there's an audiobook available and also Kindle version as well.
Brilliant. Any thoughts or discussions about translation into another language yet?
Ah, yes. I signed, this was part of last year, I signed a deal with a Spanish publisher. So they're translating it into Spanish and into Italian at the moment. I've had inquiries from a French publisher and also one in Poland, but that's all early days for that. So,
brilliant. It's a good job I ask these questions. You're not very good at promoting yourself, are you?
No, not really.
That's absolutely fantastic news. That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it's really good.
Oh, superb. So any sort of timeline on when that might be happening?
I signed the Spanish and Italian publishing contract in November of last year. So literally 2 or 3 months ago. Okay. So they are translating it now. They've started to translate it. But I think it's going to be a year probably. I think these things take time.
Well, keep us posted, and we'll let everybody know when those are ready. It's been great talking to you. Been great catching up again with you, Elspeth. And thanks for having us here.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to chat with Elspeth. If you've not read Lone Rider yet, I'd thoroughly recommend it, although it'll definitely make you want to escape on your own road trip. So be careful what you wish for. And great news that it's going to be published in several other languages too, so it can reach many more adventure riding fans. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Elspeth today, and be sure that we'll be back very soon with the next episode of Ride and Talk. Bye for now.